Okay, good morning. Welcome, everybody, to Bio 231. It is March 28th, and we're going to finish up central nervous system today, maybe move into peripheral nervous system. And don't forget, next week is spring break, so no classes next week. But the week right after spring break on Wednesday, which is like today, is going to be your third lecture exam. All right, so basically, it's 2 weeks from today, but next week, don't forget, it's spring break. All right, does anybody have any questions? And then practicums will be done today, and then right after spring break, no practicum. So we won't have another practicum for about 3 weeks, or 4 weeks because of spring break. All right, anybody have any questions over central nervous system, what we've talked about so far? What are the two main parts of the central nervous system? Brain and spinal cord. And so we're talking about the brain first, and we're starting by looking at the brain stem, which is the lowest part of the brain, right? It's the most inferior part. It's the oldest part of the central nervous system in all animals, and it's connected to the spinal cord. So here you can see the line of demarcation between the medulla oblongata and the spinal cord, and that's where it goes exactly right through the occipital bone. What's that passageway in the occipital bone called? Yeah, the foramen magnum, right? Okay, so that first bump as you move superiorly from the spinal cord into the brain through the foramen magnum is the medulla oblongata, and it works with the pons, controls a lot of autonomic functions in your body like swallowing, coughing, sneezing, helps regulate blood pressure, all of that kind of stuff. So this is a review from last time. And that is the brain stem, the medulla and the pons. Okay, the next region right here, I think we were beginning to talk about, that's the midbrain, just superior to the brain stem. It helps connect the brain stem to higher centers of the brain, for instance, like the cerebral cortex right here, or the cerebrum. And this is where you have appreciation of all of your sensory information. That's where you can appreciate vision. In, for instance, in the occipital lobe, and sensation on the surface of your skin in the parietal lobe right here. And so the midbrain connects these lower centers with these higher centers in the brain. That's why it's called the midbrain. And the main bridge or the main connection between the brainstem and the cerebrum is called a peduncle. And this is the cerebral peduncle right here, part of the midbrain. It's carrying information up to the brain and then information back down toward the spinal cord through the cerebral peduncle. This blue represents fluid inside the brain, and that fluid is cerebrospinal fluid, and the structures that produce that fluid are what we call the choroid plexus, and I can see some choroid plexus right here in this chamber of the brain, right on the floor of this chamber, and then I can see some more on the roof of this chamber of the brain. It's got a different name. And then there are some chambers that are way off of midline. So this is a mid-sagittal section, which we can't see laterally very well, so this is right on midline. There are some more chambers in the brain that are lateral, and they also have some choroid plexus that makes cerebrospinal fluid. That cerebrospinal fluid flows between the different chambers. For instance, through the interventricular foramen right here between the third ventricle, which is in this area here, and the lateral ventricles, which we can't see on this illustration. Right? There's also another passageway. This one's a little bit longer, so it's more like a canal. It's not really a foramen, but it's a connection between the third ventricle and the fourth ventricle. And that fourth ventricle is between the cerebellum and the pons. That connection is called the cerebral aqueduct. Some people might know it by another name. Sometimes it's called the aqueductus sylvius. Maybe you've learned that in another class. It's the same thing as the cerebral aqueduct. So the cerebral aqueduct is a major part of the midbrain as well. All right, so you got a cerebral peduncle, the cerebral aqueduct. And then I see two bumps over here. Commonly they're called bodies. Right? That's what corpora means. And we see two on one side, two on the other side, so there are four altogether, and collectively they're called the corpora quadra gemina, and they're also part of the midbrain. So there's a superior one and an inferior one. Each one of these bumps is called a colliculus, right? And so you have two superior colliculi and two inferior colliculi, and they have different functions. The superior colliculus is important for visual reflexes. It allows your eyes to latch onto an object and fixate on that object, whether it is stationary or if it's moving, so that you don't lose track of it as it starts to move, or even if it's moving in a complicated fashion. All right, so the superior colliculus is for optical tracking. And the inferior colliculus is a little bit different. That's for the sense of hearing. It allows you to localize where sound is coming from in three-dimensional space, either to the right of you or left of you, because if sound is being produced on the right side of your body, guess what ear it reaches first? Your right ear, okay? And then your left ear hears it. And the inferior colliculus can actually make a measurement in the difference in time between the sound reaching your right ear and left ear, and then it can position it, how far to the right is it, or is it more on midline? So if sound reaches both ears at the same time, then the inferior colliculus knows that it's right in front of you, or overhead, or behind you, right smack on your midline. Okay, so that's the job of the superior colliculus and inferior colliculus, collectively called the corpora quadrigemina, and they're part of the midbrain, right, of the brain of the human, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. And then here are those cerebral peduncles once again. Between the pons and the medulla, right here, is a network of nerves that we call the reticular activating formation. Oh, and I think maybe we did talk about this last time. Reticular activating formation has reverberating circuits. What can you tell me about a reverberating circuit once it is stimulated one time? It goes back and it stimulates itself again. It's self-stimulating, right? So if it's stimulated one time, then it will repeat that pattern over and over and over and over again. So the reticular activating system allows, once it's activated, allows sensory information to pass through the brainstem up to the higher centers for your appreciation, for your conscious, right, appreciation of that stimulus, which is what we call a wakeful state. So when the reticular activating system is activated, you're in a wakeful state. When it becomes fatigued, you fall asleep, and then it regenerates. When you're asleep, it regenerates those neuronal pathways. All right, so that's reticular formation. Reticular formation is not a particular structure, just a network of nerves that's loosely wound between the pons and the medulla. Okay. We also said that the pons is a relay station for information entering the cerebellum right here. Cerebellum maintains equilibrium and a coordinated muscle state in your body so that you can walk and walk upstairs and things like that without tripping and falling over, or even doing something simple like writing on a piece of paper, right? So there are like little subroutines for stereotypic kinds of muscle motions that you've learned in your body over time. They're stored in the cerebellum so that you don't ever have to think about how do you write a number 2 on a piece of paper or a B or a C. That muscle memory is pretty much included right here in the cerebellum. And so the cerebellum has to share information with the brainstem. Information can go back and forth, and I can't see it on this diagram right here, but there's a bridge between the pons and the cerebellum that we call a peduncle. Right, so here is a bridge between the brainstem and the cerebrum. This is the cerebral peduncle. The bridge between the pons and the cerebellum is what we call the cerebellar peduncle. You have some pretty good pictures in your book. If I have time, I'll go find them and show them to you. But I don't want to leave this slide right at the moment. All right, so above the brainstem and above the midbrain is the diencephalon. On either side of the third ventricle, which is in this region right here, one of the highest centers in the diencephalon is the thalamus. And the job of the thalamus is to take sensory information, which means information coming up from the spinal cord. It stops here and it goes through a synapse, and then that second neuron takes that information to the appropriate part of the cerebral hemisphere for your appreciation of whatever that stimulus is. So if it's an auditory signal, right, it goes to the temporal lobe. If it's a visual signal, then it goes to the occipital lobe. If it's sensation on the surface of your body, which we call somatosensation, it goes to the postcentral gyrus. And people that have lab know where that is. I'll show you where that is in just a little bit. So that's the job of the thalamus. It's a relay station. kind of like the pons is a relay station for information going in and out of the cerebellum. But the thalamus is not involved with information leaving the cerebrum, only information entering or going to the cerebral cortex. And there are two lobes of the thalamus. The lobes are connected by this interthalamic adhesion. That's what this is. It's kind of a bridge between different lobes of the thalamus. Below the thalamus, we have a structure called the hypothalamus. That's easy to appreciate, right? Hypo just means below. And the hypothalamus controls a number of things in your body. Okay? Hypothalamus can control body temperature, for instance. It gives you a sensation of thirst when you're dehydrated. But it also controls another important endocrine gland, namely the pituitary. And I can see the anterior and posterior pituitary on this diagram. This is controlled by neurons within the hypothalamus. And so the hypothalamus is considered an endocrine gland as well because it releases things that we call neurohormones. And also hormones, neurohormones released by the posterior pituitary, hormones that are called releasing factors, which cause the release of other hormones from the anterior pituitary. And there's a bridge between the pituitary, both the anterior and posterior pituitary, to the hypothalamus, and it is this structure right here. Okay, and that's what we call the infundibulum, or the stalk of the pituitary. That's what holds the pituitary in position. But don't forget, the pituitary is securely held within the cranial vault. What is that fossa called? And what bone is that in? It's the sella turcica of which bone? The sphenoid bone. That was a couple of practicums away already. It's amazing how fast this class goes. But hopefully you can remember that sella turcica and the sphenoid bone is where this pituitary gland is situated. All right, and don't forget, endocrine chapter is on the next test coming up. So there's a blood vessel, a portal blood vessel that takes hormones from the hypothalamus to the anterior pituitary, but there's a tract that takes electrical signals from the hypothalamus to the posterior pituitary, which releases neurohormones directly into the blood. All right, so that's the pituitary gland. Not really part of the diencephalon. It's part endocrine gland and part nervous tissue, but that is the diencephalon, the thalamus and hypothalamus. And I suppose there's another part right here. This is called the pineal gland. Sometimes it's called the epithalamus because it's sort of located a little bit superior, depending on the illustration, above the thalamus. And that's an endocrine gland as well. It secretes melatonin. So you got the pineal gland, thalamus, and hypothalamus. All right, so that takes us to the cerebrum. So here is the cerebrum. I'll outline it right here. This whole structure is the cerebrum, okay, minus the diencephalon right there, minus the cerebellum. That is, how would you consider that, the smallest part of the brain or the largest part of the brain? Definitely the largest part of the brain. And when you look at the surface of the cerebrum, okay, and remember, every surface part of an organ or superficial part of an organ is called what? It's called the cortex, right? So here is the cerebral cortex as opposed to the medulla, which is the deep part of any kind of organ. So here's the cerebral cortex, and is it nice and flat if you look at it, like a tabletop? Or does it have a different presentation to you? Is it nice and smooth and flat, like the tabletop that you're writing on? It is not. It has all these wrinkles in the surface of the brain. And these wrinkles are what we call convolutions. So a wrinkle is just the way that a very big, flat structure can be arranged so that it fits into a smaller spot. And what gives organisms intelligence is the number of neurons that they have in the cortex of their brain. So the bigger the cortex is, the more processing power they have, the better perceptive abilities they have, the better abilities they have to integrate information and make decisions. So the human brain is very large because it has a large surface area. It's like as big as a tabletop, but it's got to fit inside your head. So what has evolution figured out what to do? I'm thinking of evolution like a person or a consciousness, not quite really. But it has done what? It has folded up, okay, the brain so that it fits into a smaller spot. And those folds are what we call convolutions. So you have lots of processing power in the cortex, but it can still fit into a small space. And a convolution has two parts to it. There's going to be a fold or a depression, and then there's going to be a high spot or a ridge. This ridge right here is what we call a gyrus, and a depression is what we call a, what do we call that sulcus between the tubercles of your humerus? The intertubercular groove, but it's got another name, sulcus, right? And in neurology, we call it a sulcus, not necessarily a groove. So here is a sulcus, here is a gyrus, which is followed by a, another sulcus, which is followed by a gyrus, which is followed by another sulcus, right? So these produce folds or convolutions. So convolution in the surface of the brain has those two parts. All right, so we see these convolutions. The cerebrum also has different lobes. The lobe that is anterior is underneath or deep to what cranial bone? What cranial bone is right here? Yeah, that's the frontal bone. And that's how we name this lobe. So this is the frontal lobe of the cerebrum. Then back over here, what bone would be back over here in your cranium? Parietal bone. So this is the parietal lobe. And then way back over here, what bone would this be in this region? Occipital. So here is the occipital lobe. So those are three of the four main lobes of the cerebrum: frontal, parietal, and occipital. And if we look at a nice lateral view, we can also find the fourth lobe of the brain. As a matter of fact, let's look at this picture of a real human brain. So here's the, I see what, convolutions all over the place. I see a gyrus here and a sulcus. Here's the frontal lobe. What's this lobe over here? That's the occipital lobe, and in between the frontal and occipital is the parietal lobe. All right, and another important lobe of the cerebral, of the cerebrum is this lobe right here. Go ahead, tell me what lobe this is. Because you know your bones, that's where the temporal bone is, so that is the temporal lobe. So those are the four main lobes. The cerebellum is not a lobe of the cerebrum, it's a special part of the brain all by itself, right? So we don't really consider it a lobe. And I can see the brain stem, maybe a little bit of spinal cord, the cerebral peduncles over here, part of the midbrain. Okay, so the gyri are nicely visible. There is a big separation between the occipital lobe and the cerebellum, and a very deep separation, a complete separation from different parts of the brain is what we call a fissure. And this is what we call the transverse fissure, because what plane does it exist in? Nice transverse plane right there between the occipital lobe and the cerebellum. This right here could be considered a fissure, but typically we don't talk about it as a fissure. The separation between the temporal and parietal lobes, we're going to call this the lateral sulcus between the temporal lobe and other parts of the brain. All right, and we're going to go to a previous slide. So here is a view from above the brain looking down. So here's anterior and posterior. And we're looking at the cerebrum, and in particular the cerebral cortex, because I can see all these gyri and sulci right here. And here is another deep depression. Kind of reminds me of the transverse sulcus, but it, notice it's right mid-sagittal plane. So we call this the longitudinal fissure. It's a very deep separation between the right and left hemispheres of the brain, of the cerebrum. So the cerebrum has two hemispheres, and they're separated from each other by the longitudinal fissure. Okay. All right, so you have a left part of the brain and a right part of the brain. They're not really connected to each other because the longitudinal fissure is separating them. So do you think it might be a good idea for our brains to know, for instance, what the right hemisphere is thinking? Should the left hemisphere know that? Should information be shared between the left and right hemispheres of your brain? Okay, or should they be separate? Well, if they were separate, you would have like two different people inside your head. Okay, so it's really a good idea that the left side of the brain knows what the right side is thinking. But electrical signals can't get through the longitudinal fissure right here, but there has got to be a way. Let me show you the way that signals can get back and forth. Let's go back to that figure that we were looking at just previously, which is which is right here. Where is it? Ah, here it is. Okay. All right, so here is the right side of the brain, and we can see the longitudinal fissure, right, is causing this separation. And here is the corpus callosum. And notice there, you know, I don't see any convolutions because it is a solid structure. This is a bridge between the right and left sides of the cerebrum. So signals can go from left to right through the corpus callosum so that the right side of the brain does know what the left side is thinking so that it can be coordinated. And that's really important because different sides of the brain have different abilities, right? Math ability is on one side. Language ability is on the other. Okay, creative ability is on one side. So these different abilities are localized, but they have to be integrated in with all the other functions of the brain. And this is how the hemispheres can share information. When electrical information moves from right to left in the central nervous system, especially in the brain, we call it a commissural pathway. Let's see, corpus callosum right here doesn't say anything about a commissure, but the corpus callosum has commissural pathways that don't take information up or down, but take things from right to left only. Okay, and we have other commissural pathways. Like here is an anterior commissure. This is another pathway that takes information, how, in your brain? Up or down, front to back, right to left, through this anterior commissure. And the same thing for a posterior commissure. Where is that located? Ah, right here. All right, here's the posterior commissure. Shares the general same kind of function as the corpus callosum. Okay, frontal lobe. Let's look in the frontal lobe in particular. All right, there's a special area called Broca's area. Let me get a picture of this up. Now, where do you have the motor in your car? Where do you have the motor inside your car? In the front. Depends on what kind of car you have, right? Some of you might have... But generally speaking, where do we like to put the motor? In most cars, where do you find it? In the front, okay? And so the frontal lobe right here, right, is involved with controlling motor activity, especially voluntary motion in your body. So this area is connected to what kind of effector organs? If it's voluntary motion, skeletal muscle. It's connected to skeletal muscles. It's also connected through the somatic motor nervous system. Somatic means going to voluntary muscles. And here is the separation between the parietal lobe and the frontal lobe. We call this the central sulcus. Remember, a sulcus is a depression. Here is that first gyrus, just anterior to the central sulcus. We call this the precentral gyrus. This is the area of the brain that controls all of your skeletal muscles. It causes them to contract or to relax on your conscious command right here. So if we were to stimulate this area, right where the cursor is, with some electrical kind of current or other kind of stimulus, what's going to happen to your body? Will you perceive something or will something move? Since this is the primary somatomotor cortex, right, some part of your body is going to move. Right, if we stimulate this area, because the frontal lobe is involved with what? Motor activity in your body, which means motion. And in particular, skeletal muscle in this part of the brain. All right, who's got a motor or an engine right in the middle of their car? Anybody have one of those cars? That would be, an MR2 probably doesn't have one in the middle. They're in the back, if with an MR2. All right, but really fancy cars have motors, and like Maseratis and Ferraris and things like that. I don't know anybody that has one. I wanted to go for a drive in it. That's why I asked. Okay. All right, but mostly motors are in the front. So think motor, frontal cortex right here, frontal lobe. All right, and in particular, there's one area that's called Broca's area, which is motor for speech. So if that area gets damaged, you might be completely normal. You might be able to hear things properly. You might be able to think of concepts in your native language, but you won't be able to vocalize any kind of communication sounds as a result. You might wish to. You might have form those words in your mind, but you just won't be able to pronounce them.
All right, so where is Broca's area? What should we be looking at? I know, that's kind of funny. Here we go.
All right, so here's that central sulcus once again. Here's the primary motor cortex for motion, right, which is not speech. But here is Broca's area. So if there's damage to this area in the cerebrum, and what area, what lobe is this right here? Frontal lobe, that's basically what we think is motor, then you won't be able to form any language sounds as a result. Okay, so Broca's area is pretty important. Skeletal muscle, okay, is controlled by this precentral gyrus. I do want you to know that. And the way that it's arranged, okay, is in a little homunculus. Do I have homunculus on here? Oh, yeah, right here. Let me see if I can find homunculus. All right, so what does a homunculus? Homunculus is a little person. Oh, why don't I see the little person here? Ah, here I see a little person. Next slide up. Okay, so here we have anterior. Let's look at the overall look of these cerebral hemispheres. Here's anterior, here's posterior. So what lobe of the brain is this? That's the frontal lobe, right? So the central sulcus is where these planes are. And the precentral gyrus is color-coded in red. So that's the precentral gyrus. That's this one over here. That's the primary motor cortex. That's what produces motion in your body. And the way that the neurons are laid out is that your head and face are in this region right up over here. And as you proceed more toward the lateral fissure, or longitudinal fissure, right, then there's an area for your fingers and your hand, and then a little bit of your forearm, okay? Because what kind of dexterity do you have with your forearm? What can you do with your forearm compared to your hand? What can you do with your hand? Well, you can flex, you can extend, you can abduct and adduct, you got opposition on the thumb, okay? And you can flex all those fingers, right? As well as the wrist, so it requires a lot of nerves, so there is a large surface area right here, because you have a high degree of dexterity with this particular appendage, right? So you have a lot of neurons. But what can you do with your forearm? Not very much, right? I mean, you can supinate and pronate, but that's about it, right? So you don't need a lot of nerves to do that kind of activity, right? So there are very, very few nerves. What's another area of your body where you have a lot of dexterity, a lot of control, fine control over various aspects of that part of the body, huh? Your face, right, for facial expression, right, for controlling your mouth, for articulation, for your eyes, for blinking, okay? And look, your tongue is pretty small, but look at how large an area of your brain, all right, it takes up, because it's necessary for speech. So the face is all located in this area. So if we were to stimulate this area of the precentral gyrus right here, not up over here, not in the longitudinal fissure, but right here, what would happen? What would happen if we took a little electrical current? And you would blink. Yeah, your eyes would blink, okay, as a result of that. Or if we stimulated, let's stimulate maybe this part right here. What would happen? I tell you what, right here, what would happen? Your toes would wiggle, okay? All right, and notice that we don't have a lot of neurons controlling our toes, so typically we can't use them for very much. But, of course, people that are missing limbs can develop this area to do more things than we can do normally, but still this big toe still can't oppose the other toes. Your great toes still can't oppose the other toes because we just don't have the processing power or the proper joints in the foot to do that. All right, so here's a little homuncular man right here. And that's in what lobe of the brain? What lobe controls motor activity? Skeletal muscles? The frontal lobe, yeah, frontal lobe. So this is the precentral gyrus that we see right here, because remember, this is anterior. Anterior is red, which is motor. This postcentral gyrus is sensory. And notice, it's going to be laid out pretty much in the same way. Okay, we're going to get to parietal lobe in just a second. Something else having to do with motion are the basal nuclei. Nuclei, or a nucleus inside the brain, is a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, and it is gray matter. It doesn't have myelin around it. Only axons have myelin around them. years and years ago, they used to be called the basal ganglia, right? And the ganglia is also a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, but in a more modern nomenclature, ganglia are located in the peripheral nervous system, not central nervous system. So most modern day books, these things are going to be called the basal nuclei, but this terminology, basal ganglia, still persists. But you should realize that the classical term basal ganglia refers to areas of gray matter in the central nervous system. And in particular, this region right here. Oops, this region over here. Let me show you. I need to find a different cross-section of the brain. Let's look right here. All right, so here is the brain. So it's going through the frontal lobe and then out through the occipital lobe over here. And in the frontal lobe, we have a number of gray areas. Like we have the caudate nucleus. Right, we have the putamen and the globus pallidus, and you don't have to know the names of any of these things, but you should know what the location is. They're in the frontal lobe, and these things are involved with helping control motion in your body. Okay, and in particular, for instance, if you contract the biceps, what else has to be happening when you contract the biceps in order for your forearm to move? Somebody's pointing over here. What has to happen to this muscle? What is this muscle over here? Triceps, all right, that's good, because you've got a practicum this week, right? So biceps, when the biceps contracts, what has to happen to the triceps that will allow you to flex your arm? It has to relax and it has to stretch, right? So if the biceps is contracting and the triceps can't relax, what's going to happen to your arm? You can pull as hard as you want with your biceps, but your forearm is not going to move. All right, so when you tell your biceps to contract, there has to be nerve signals that go to the triceps to cause the triceps to relax so that you can move your arm, right? And that involves these nuclei in the frontal lobe, what we call the basal nuclei, or what your book calls the basal ganglia. So they're important because they inhibit motions, antagonistic muscles, so that a particular motion can take place in a very nice, fluid manner. Right, so people with a motion disorder due to a disruption of the basal ganglia, maybe the neurotransmitters aren't working, or maybe the basal ganglia were damaged because of head trauma, car accident, motorcycle accident, then when somebody contracts a prime mover, the antagonistic muscle doesn't relax and they have great difficulty moving in a nice fluid motion that we just take for granted. Right, so the basal nuclei inhibit antagonistic muscles so that you have nice fluid motion. The disease process, anybody know the name of that disease process where the basal nuclei become damaged and people can't move properly, so they have, they speak kind of funny, their speech is very slurred, their motion is very staggered, they kind of look like they're intoxicated with alcohol? It's called Parkinson's disease, right, Parkinson's disease. That involves the basal nuclei, which are in these regions right here. And you can actually see them really nicely, right, these gray areas. You might know some people with Parkinson's disease, right, and they have the appearance of being intoxicated in their whole life, which is really inappropriate, right, to be intoxicated. Like if you were to come to class, or if I were to come to class intoxicated, it would be very inappropriate. And when you have patients that come and see you in your clinics or hospitals, that's very inappropriate too. And then if you notice somebody like that, you're thinking, oh, substance abuser. And substance abusers can be fairly dangerous because a lot of times they will do just about anything for drugs, right? So there's a barrier that comes up between people that will go into clinical practice like you and their patients, which is a terrible thing, right? But you do have to protect yourself. But never confuse anybody that has Parkinson's disease with a substance abuser, right? Two totally different kinds of processes taking place right there. And if you treat somebody with Parkinson's disease like they're intoxicated inappropriately or a drug seeker, that would be horrible, right? Because they're not that kind of person. They don't need that particular kind of treatment or help in their daily life, and you just might lose the respect of them for a really long time if you treat somebody like that. So be aware. What are some people, you know anybody, what are the names of some people that have Parkinson's disease? Maybe some famous people. Michael J. Fox is one person, okay? So this part of his brain is damaged, probably won't ever grow back again or heal itself. And He got it at a very early age. And usually when it's early onset, it's due to drug abuse. So there are drugs that can bind to receptors in this part of the brain that poison those receptors, which then damage the basal nuclei, and then they can't relax certain parts of their body when they're moving, and they're just always fighting. Their muscles are fighting up against each other. All right, but Michael J. Fox has always said that he never abused drugs when he was younger. And now they're beginning to realize that maybe somebody poisoned him at some point in his career, because a number of child actors that he was involved with are coming down with Parkinson's disease as well at an early age. And so what they're thinking now is that a TV producer spiked the drinks of all the child actors with amphetamines or amphetamine-like materials so that they would be up for the period of time when they were filming, right, because it's very expensive to film. And as a result, when they were using those illicit drugs, that it actually damaged the brains of these child actors, including Michael J. Fox. And of course, there's no way to go back and check exactly when that happened or maybe who did that. So that's one thing. There's another person, another example of why you could get Parkinson's disease. And that is, anybody ever hear of Muhammad Ali? It's a little bit before your time, but what can you tell me about Muhammad Ali? A boxer, right? And these boxers are just incredibly big, powerful people, and somebody hit his head really hard a number of times, and that trauma is enough to damage the brain, as we see in this case. But it could happen to us, too, in a car accident or motorcycle accident or whatever. Okay, so in Muhammad Ali's case, he's not suspected of abusing drugs, but clearly it's just due to having his head pounded by those incredibly strong people. All right, so that's the basal nuclei. Way in the front, what we call the prefrontal cortex, right? That's not really involved in controlling motion or motor activities in your body, but it's for cognition, for thinking, for understanding proper social settings and interacting with your environment in socially acceptable ways, okay? Like, I don't walk into lab cursing and swearing because somebody left the microscope out. Even though I might feel like it, my prefrontal cortex is what? Saying, oh, you know, control yourself. Don't be too bizarre. But if the prefrontal if I did damage my prefrontal cortex, then what would happen to my personality? It would change as a result of that, right? Okay. And there are examples in the literature of some pretty amazing examples of how that changed for people. And psychology courses like to talk about that. Anybody know the name of a person that's used in psychology classes that shows that? Yeah, the guy that was working on a railroad, right? And he was digging this channel to put some dynamite in, and they packed the dynamite with a big metal bar, and as he was packing the dynamite in with the bar, the dynamite went off and this big metal bar went up through his mandible, through his mouth, and then up through the frontal cortex. And he lived, okay, made a nice clean hole, but before that accident, he was a good employee, never swore at anybody, showed up to work on time. After the accident, he still had good motor control, but showed up late to work, swearing all the time, okay, probably trying to place dynamite in other places besides the railway bed that they were trying to make. Okay, so the severe personality disorder. I think his name, least reported in textbooks, is Phineas Gage. You could do a Google on Phineas Gage. Okay, so that's the prefrontal cortex. Parietal lobe. Well, you kind of know where the parietal lobe is. That's the primary sensory cortex for touch, pressure, and pain on the surface of your body. And if it's on the surface of your body, we call that a somatic sensation. All right, so it's the primary somatosensory cortex on your body. Where do we have that slide once again? I think it was back up over here. Primary somatosensory cortex. Where's that little homunculus guy? You see it? Ah, right here. Okay. All right, so here is just a nice picture, top-down view of the brain. Okay, so here's anterior, so here's frontal lobe, here's posterior, so here is the parietal lobe. So the postcentral gyrus is in blue, so let's move that over to the side, and we can see the cortex in blue. That's where all the nerve cell bodies and dendrites are. And this is for sensation. And notice, if this is sensation on your thumb in the postcentral gyrus, if we go to the precentral gyrus, we find the motor cortex for what part of your body? So it's thumb and thumb, but in one location it's motor, in the other location, or one gyrus, like the precentral gyrus, it's motor, in the postcentral gyrus it's for sensation. So if we were to stimulate this red area right here, what would happen? Your thumb would move. But if we stimulate the postcentral gyrus in that same location, what would happen? Would your thumb move? No, because it's not motor cortex, it's sensory. You would feel some sensation on your thumb as a result of that, okay? Or some sensation on your nose, right? Or on your lips or whatever, or on the top of your head. Okay, so we can map out different surface areas on your body by these different gyri and sulcus that are in those different locations inside your brain, namely the postcentral gyrus for sensation, the precentral gyrus for motor control. And don't forget, primary motor cortex, primary somatomotor cortex is in the frontal lobe. The primary somatosensory cortex is in the parietal lobe. So that's what you should know about the parietal lobe. Temporal lobe, right, is the primary auditory cortex and has olfactory areas as well. So that when your ear sends signals to your brain for your appreciation of sound, it goes to the temporal lobe right about in this location right here. Okay, so that's part of the temporal lobe. So that's probably a good thing to remember. Occipital lobe, way in the back, that's the primary visual center. So if we were to stimulate the occipital lobe, what would be your experience? Would something move in your body? You would actually visualize something, okay? It wouldn't be anything that you would normally see in reality, all right? But you would have some kind of visual experience, maybe a flash or colors, or see something due to that stimulation of the occipital lobe. Also in this area, kind of between the parietal and the occipital lobe, is another important area. Let's see if I can find this area pretty easily. Pretty good. All right, so here's the primary visual cortex. All right, so this is where you can appreciate some very basic kinds of visual signals. And then these other association areas get information from the primary visual cortex, and then these signals are arranged in certain kinds of patterns, and even maybe by color. So you might be able to recognize dark areas and light areas on a piece of paper, and form those patterns of light and dark into letters, for instance. So the formation of letters in your mind doesn't happen in the primary visual cortex, but in these association areas, which are a little bit more proximal to this vision center right here. All right, and then if we get into an area between the parietal lobe and temporal lobe, here's that primary auditory cortex where you actually can appreciate sound, right? And then here's the visual center. This area right here is what we call Wernicke's area, kind of in between the different lobes of the brain. And this is where you have the appreciation of language, where you can hear sounds, where you can actually see somebody form words with their lips and their face. All that information comes to this area right here, and then you can make words and sentences and meaning out of all of those sensory experiences. We call that Wernicke's area. All right, so if this area is damaged, right, you might be able to speak just fine, but you really won't be able to interact with anybody because you won't know what they're saying. If the Broca's area gets damaged and the Wernicke's area is fine, you can understand exactly what everybody's telling you, but you can't respond to them because you can't form a language, right? You can't speak a language. You might be able to type it out on a computer or something like that, but you just won't be able to form language with your breath and vocal sounds. All right, so those are some important parts of the cerebrum. I want to talk about some pathways between different parts of the brain. We talked about these a little bit already, okay, and it has to do with how signals are shared inside the brain. Okay, so some signals, okay, move up and down through the spinal cord. They move up and down through the brain from superior to inferior. We call those projection fibers. All right, so projection fibers are for ascending and descending tracts to and from the cortical gray areas of the brain. They're vertically aligned. Some examples will be the internal capsule. That's the beginning of the cortical spinal tract and the corona radiata. So look at all of these pathways right here. We call these radiations. So information that goes to the thalamus then gets spread to different areas of the cerebrum, and they kind of shines out like sun rays, right? So they call that, these are radiations. So radiation pathways are projection fibers that are moving superiorly or inferiorly, for instance. A pretty good example of inferior motion. Okay, so here is the thalamus right here. Here are the basal nuclei, and these, of course, have nerve cell bodies and dendrites that are not myelinated, so they're gray, right? Myelinated parts of the brain look white because they're axons that are covered with oligodendrocytes. All right, and here we have some white matter between the thalamus and the basal nuclei, and this is what we call the internal capsule. This is the internal capsule for signals that are going from the cerebral cortex down into the spinal cord. So these are descending pathways that go through the internal capsule between the thalamus and the basal nuclei. And I can see the internal capsule right here very nicely. Right? It's nice white matter. Those are projection fibers. Commissural fibers, we say, were ways for information to go from one side of the brain to the other. So here are some commissural pathways. So there could be some neurons up over here that want to share information to the other side of the brain. So they have to descend to the level of the corpus callosum, and then they can move to the other side of the brain and then move back up to the appropriate part of the cerebral cortex. So these are what we call commissural pathways. All right, so projection goes up and down, commissural goes right and left. And the third kind of pathways or fibers that we have are what we call association fibers. Association fibers go from one gyrus to a neighboring gyrus, right, to share information, but not from the left side of the brain all the way over to the right side, or not from a superior location to an inferior location. All right, it's just simply from one gyrus to another. So I can see some association fibers right here. Okay, so you got these three kinds of different fibers in the cerebrum. All right, cerebellum, we pointed out where that was. It's for balance. It continuously is adjusting postural muscles, right, to maintain balance. Like if I were to walk up to somebody that's sleeping in class, maybe in the front row, and bonk them on the shoulder pretty hard, that would have a tendency to knock them out of their chair, but that cerebellum is going to say, ah, your body's out of control, before you even wake up. And what's the cerebellum going to do? It's going to cause other muscles to contract so that you don't fall on the floor when that happens. Okay, so, or if you're just walking down the sidewalk and you have a friend bump into you for fun, okay, you don't necessarily lose your balance because the cerebellum takes over and says, ah, your body's going out of control. You better contract that muscle and this one so that you don't lose your balance. Now, do you have to consciously think about when you're losing your balance? Ooh, I better start contracting that gastrocnemius a little bit more. Oh, the biceps femoris. Ah, that semimembranosus is way too slack. I need to develop a little tension in there. Do you have to consciously think about all those muscles? Obviously not. The cerebellum does that for you, right? That's really pretty handy. Okay, so that's the job of the cerebellum. Spinal cord, right? It extends, right, superiorly from the foramen magnum down to the second lumbar vertebrae. So let's take a look at spinal cord. That's way back up over here. So here's spinal cord. Here is the occipital bone, cerebellum. So here's foramen magnum. So spinal cord goes from foramen magnum down to about the level of L2. And then down below the level of L2, you still have a vertebral canal, but you don't have a spinal cord. You just have nerves going through this region right here. And that's because the spinal cord can't grow as fast as the rest of your body during development. And it doesn't need to be as long as your vertebral column is. So it's just held in place as you're growing. Vertebral column gets longer and longer and longer so that you can get taller. All right, there's something that I see like a little conical structure. I'm going to lose the arrow if I do this, but I want to zoom into this region right here. Right about at the level of L2. All right, this little conical structure right here is the very tip of the spinal cord, and then we just have nerves down over here. These nerves are what we call the cauda equina because they reminded somebody of what? What does equina mean? What's an equestrian? Somebody that rides a horse. Yeah, so cauda equina. Cauda means tail. It just means horse's tail because that reminded somebody of a horse's tail. All these different nerves right here. The conus medullaris is the tip, the distal end of the spinal cord. So we call that the conus medullaris. And then there's a ligament that goes from the conus medullaris down to the sacrum, and that's the phylum terminale. It puts a little tension on the spinal cord so that it doesn't retract and go back up to your brain, right? Which is really handy because your spinal cord really should be in your vertebral column, not all bunched up at the base of your brain, right? So no conus medullaris, cauda equina, and the phylum terminale here. Sometimes during development, the conus medullaris has an adhesion which glues it to the sacrum. And then when somebody starts to grow rapidly, guess what happens to the spinal cord? It gets stretched and ripped apart when a person is growing. It's called a tethered cord, tethered spinal cord. And of course, that produces really nasty neurological deficits when that happens. The sooner it's diagnosed, the better, because that adhesion can be released, right? And their spinal cord goes back to that normal location when that happens. All right, so this is about the level of L2. Other things that we see on the spinal cord right here is that, let's move it over, some regions look thicker than other regions, right? Like right here, this is what we call the cervical enlargement. And then down over here, we have the lumbar enlargement. So what can you tell me? The spinal cord belongs to what major part of your nervous system? Central nervous system. That's right, central nervous system. So central nervous system is responsible for taking in sensory information from all over your body, integrating it, and making a decision on what to do with that information. So in these areas right here, there are more neurons right here and right here for taking in more information than other parts of your body. And what do you have emanating from this part of your body here and then down over here that requires more neurons? Your upper appendage and your lower appendage, okay? So these are the places of your spinal cord that are associated with your appendages, and it contains more neurons because there are reflexes that take place in your appendages, for instance, to protect your hand. When you grab something hot, what's going to happen when you grab something hot? You're going to drop it. As a matter of fact, you're probably going to drop it before you even know your fingers are burning, because there are signals that come into the spinal cord, and then immediately the spinal cord is going to send signals out to muscles to inhibit them so that it's going to drop that hot pan. Okay, so we're going to look at a reflex just in a little bit. But so these are areas for special kind of reflexes to take place and that are not necessary in the thoracic and abdominal region. Okay, so that's what we have right here. We can also see nerves leaving the vertebral column. These are spinal nerves, right, leaving the intervertebral foramina, the spaces between the vertebrae. Okay, let's look at a nice cross-section of spinal cord. Cross-section of spinal cord. Oh, actually, I probably want to talk about, I can talk about this right now. All right, so is the spinal cord absolutely straight on this diagram? It is not. It's curved. There are normal curvatures in the vertebral column as we look at it from right to left. So this is maybe a left view of the vertebral column. And so there's a cervical curvature, there's a thoracic curvature, right? There's a lumbar curvature and even a sacral curvature right here. So you might be wondering, why do we, is our spine all curved like that, just normally? All right, well, the thoracic curvature is there because you have a lot of organs in this area. For instance, what kind of organs? They take up space, like your lungs and your heart, right? And that pushes the vertebral column posteriorly, right? Because it makes room for all those organs. And then the sacral curvature right here, guess what you have in this area? A lot of organs, okay? Like reproductive organs, intestines and things of that nature, especially reproductive organs, right? So that needs a special little space right in this area. Well, if your whole vertebral column was positioned posteriorly and you were to stand up straight, guess which way, what would happen to you? You would have a tendency to fall. Which way would you fall if your vertebral column is way in your back? Okay, you would fall backwards because all the weight is distributed behind you, not in the center of your person. So there are other curvatures that are anterior, like the cervical curvature It moves your head anteriorly, and that promotes balance in your body. If your head was way posterior, right, you'd have a tendency to fall backwards because your head is pretty heavy. Do we have an equestrian in the class right here? How important is head position? People control their horses just by slight movements of their head because your head's pretty heavy, right? Horses can even sense that. So your vertebral column is positioned so that it moves your head anteriorly and makes it a lot easier to stand up straight and to move properly. Okay, and then the same thing for this lumbar curvature here as well, that then repositions the vertebral column so that you have more weight over the center of your body as opposed to having all the weight posterior, which would make it difficult to maintain your balance. All right, so that's what these curvatures are for. I have curvatures someplace in here. I don't know where they are, but they're in your notes someplace. All right, let's move to a nice transverse section. Okay, what are we looking through right here? You can tell me a lot about this slide already. What do you see? What bone do you see right here? What kind of bone is it? You see a bone. You see a bone, yes. What kind of bone is that? How about calcaneus? No. It's a vertebrae, right? Okay, what kind of vertebrae? That's not important for the slide, but, okay, you can probably tell me what kind of vertebrae because I see these nice transverse foramina here. So here's a cervical vertebrae. Look at that nice bifid spinous process, right? Little blast from the past. All right, here's a vertebral foramen with a spinal cord in it. Here are some spinal nerves leaving the intervertebral foramen. So here's the spinal nerve. All right, when I look at the spinal cord, it has gray matter and white matter as well. Right, the gray matter, however, is deep, and the white matter is in the cortex of the spinal cord. It's superficial, so that's unlike the brain. The brain, the gray matter is superficial. All right, white matter is myelinated axons. The gray matter is what? Nerve cell bodies and dendrites. So in the white matter, in the like the cortical areas of the spinal cord, these are tracts that are going up to the brain or tracts that are taking signals down to the bottom of the spinal cord. All right, so tracts that go up, what do we call tracts that go up? Are they motor or sensory? They're taking information to the brain, so they are sensory. Tracts that are taking signals down are motor tracts, okay? And then the connections between these different tracts, maybe where they share information or receive information from the periphery, that's this gray area right here. All right. These things are nerves that are leaving the spinal cord and going to leave the vertebral column. I got to have a better picture. Let me find a little bit better picture. Right here. This is a pretty good picture. Okay. These things are what we call roots. And there are two roots on either side of the spinal cord. All right. So again, here's the white matter. Here's the gray matter. So these are roots. And roots carry information only in one direction. And we have one in the back. This is the dorsal root. The one that's anterior is the ventral root. People use that terminology. Usually we don't say anterior root, though people would know what you're talking about. So anterior root is always going to be 100% motor. Signals are leaving the central nervous system going out into the periphery if it's a ventral root. A dorsal root is for nerve fibers bringing information into the central nervous system. So here's the dorsal root. Here's the ventral root, and a sensory neuron is always going to be a pseudo-unipolar or unipolar neuron, and the cell body is going to be located in this area right here. This is outside the central nervous system because the vertebral column is right here, so this is outside the central nervous system. So here is just typically a nerve. This is not a tract. This is just a nerve. So this right here is a group of nerve cell bodies, and what do we call a group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system? Ganglion. And this is the dorsal root ganglion, right, because it says it right here, right? That's in the peripheral nervous system. That's the main cell body of all these axons, different processes that are moving into the central nervous system. What do we call a group of nerve cell bodies in the central nervous system? We just talked about them. And a good example would be the basal nuclei. Your book calls them the basal ganglia, but don't forget that's a misnomer. So a nucleus is a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the central nervous system, like the basal nuclei. But this ganglia is truly in the peripheral nervous system. So signals come in, the dorsal root, they're analyzed within the central nervous system, which makes a decision on what to do, sends that decision out to your body via the ventral root. And a ventral root has a number of components, little rootlets, from different levels of the spinal cord. And even the dorsal root splits, bifurcates into little rootlets that brings information into various levels of the spinal cord. All right. The other thing that I notice on the spinal cord, since we're looking in transverse section, that I see some deep depressions in the spinal cord right on midline. This is what we call the dorsal median sulcus. And over here, people call this the ventral median fissure, even though the sulcus looks deeper than the fissure. Okay, if you wanted to call that a fissure, that would be okay with me. Okay, but don't get dorsal and ventral mixed up. Okay, and then here's the central canal, which contains cerebral spinal fluid coming down from the fourth ventricle of the brain. And then we have the gray part of the, or gray matter inside the spinal cord, and you see it has a certain structure to it as well. So for instance, this is the posterior or dorsal part, and it looks like a horn, so this is a dorsal horn. Here is the ventral horn, and then in some parts of the spinal cord, there's even a lateral horn in the thorax and lumbar region. There's a lateral horn right here. So those are things you have to know even in lab. These are nerve cell bodies and dendrites because it's gray matter. And the white matter even has different names. You can think of the white matter as being bundles of cables or wires that are taking information up or down. All right, so we can call these columns or a funiculus. Either one, funiculus or column, or just myelinated tracts, either ascending or descending. All right, so here is a dorsal column, here's a ventral column, here's the lateral column over here. So it looks pretty complicated, but it's not really too complicated to label these things. The other thing I notice on this slide is that there are some membranes that surround the spinal cord. And indeed, every part of the central nervous system, which includes the brain and the spinal cord, has these different membranes around them that we call the meninges. There's a really thick one, which is the most superficial. We call that the dura mater. Right, that's the thickest, toughest ones, which is what? The most durable one. It can withstand a lot of stress. That's the dura mater. And then the one that's right in the middle is called the arachnoid. And then the one that lines every surface, every little crease and sulcus and fissure on the surface of the spinal cord and the brain is what we call the pia mater. That's the most delicate one. It's kind of difficult to see. Maybe in lab we can actually see it when we start doing a brain dissection, if we're really careful. But the one that's going to be hard to cut through is the dura mater. That's going to be like shoe leather, as a matter of fact. Okay, so the dorsal root right here is bringing information in, so, and only in. It's one-way traffic. Information can only enter the spinal cord through the dorsal root. Can't enter the ventral root. The ventral root is purely for motor signals leaving. So how would you classify the dorsal root? What's one way to classify this dorsal root right here? How do you talk about sensory? What's another way? Afferent, okay. And the ventral root is going to be 100% efferent, leaving the spinal cord. Okay, so over here you got dorsal root is sensory, ventral root is motor. All right, we talked about these things already, gray matter, spinal cord. What else do I have? Oh, I bet I have another couple pages. We were talking about this. Ah, here is a pathway that can share information from gray matter on the right side to gray matter on the left side of the spinal cord. What do we call some kind of pathway that can share information in the central nervous system from right to left? That's a commissural pathway, and since this one is gray, it's called the gray commissure. Okay. All right. So, in your brain, what lobe of the cerebrum is associated with motor control? The frontal lobe, which is what? Anterior. What parts of the brain are more for sensory information? The more posterior parts of the brain, like the parietal lobe and occipital lobe, right? Okay, so these tracts within the spinal cord are arranged pretty much in that same way. All right, so the anterior areas, just like your brain, is for motor activity. What about this root right here that is anterior, which we call the ventral root? What is it? It's motor, and that corresponds to the anterior parts of the brain. This is the anterior part of the spinal cord, right? So that makes sense. And the sensory root or the dorsal root, posterior root, matches up very nicely with the more posterior parts of the brain, which are used for primarily sensation in your body, right? So that matches up really nice. And the tracts, the arrangements of various tracts inside the spinal cord generally follow that same kind of rule. So tracts in the anterior part, like this anterior column right here, okay, or ventral column or ventral funiculus, are tracts that bring information, okay, down from the brain to this ventral root. They're motor. While most of the tracts that are in the posterior part of the spinal cord or this dorsal funiculus are tracts that bring information which way? Up to the brain or down from the brain out to the periphery? They're going up. All right, so most of these are sensory tracts. Most of these are going to be motor tracts. That's not 100% true, but that's a pretty good way of thinking about these different tracts and what happens to somebody when they damage different parts of their spinal cord. Are you ever concerned about damaging your spinal cord and why? Yes, because what happens? It doesn't ever grow back, right? So if you damage the spinal cord, right, and you damage these anterior tracts, then you lose motion in that part of your body, right? If you damage the more posterior parts, then you damage sensation. And if you damage both, then that's really terrible, right? Okay. So know those things. The last couple of things that I want to talk about, which I got to finish up next time on Monday, right, because, is this on the test? No, this isn't on the test, I don't think. Just the first chapter of nervous system. So muscles, endocrine system, and the first chapter on nervous is on the test, but this one isn't, so, yeah. So it's 2 weeks from today, but on that Monday, right after spring break, then I'm going to finish up talking about some tracts and the meninges. We'll go over the meninges one more time. Okay, and then move on to peripheral nervous system. The sign-in sheet is going around someplace, so make sure you sign the sign-in sheet today. And let's see if my recorder was working the whole time. And my recorder was working the whole time. That's nice.